Now, this evening's speaker is a longtime supporter of History and Heritage, and I knew him when I was in Calgary, and at that time, like the rest of the world, I mispronounced his name. But because he is a gentleman as well as a scholar, he didn't correct me. So tonight, because I'm a Banff insider now, you can always tell the insiders they pronounce it the right way. Right? So David Pito is a retired elementary school teacher and a physical education teacher. So if you're talking during the presentation, he might yell, "Drop and give me 20." So if he does, that's what's going to happen. All right. So in 2002, he began publishing, self-publishing, under the name of Pito Lake Books. Is that right?
Yes.
Pito Lake Books, good. And has just finished the fourth in the four-part series of the Banff Town Warden series. That's a series, of course, based on the journals of his grandfather, who was Banff Town Warden from 1914 to 1948, and Walter. And so those books, by the way, are available, and I should say this following the presentation, David will sign the books at the back there, and they're available at the shop there, so by all means, if you want to pick those up, in addition to some of the other books he's written. Other books he's written, of course, include, and I think these are available as well, if I'm not mistaken, is the two parts trivia book, so Bill Pito Guide to Rocky Mountain Trivia, or is that right, trivia, or is it Rocky Mountains trivia? Canadian Rockies trivia. Yeah, I've seen them before. I know that. So Canadian Rockies trivia. And also three books on Calgary's parks and green spaces, as well as one called Walk Calgary's Escarpments and Bluffs. Is it Escarpments and Bluffs?
Yes.
Right, Escarpments and Bluffs. Okay, well, if you're going to walk those, walk them carefully. However, enough from me. What I want you to do now is to welcome David Pito. I almost said Pato. I hope I didn't say that any time during my introduction, but David Pito. And please welcome him. And on with the show. Thank you.
As Bob mentioned, my program is based on my grandfather's journals. He came to Banff in 1902, and he came from Welling, Kent. And he'd actually followed his older brother, Bill, over. And there is a third brother that did come over after Walter had come over. Now, this first picture shows Walter. One of the jobs he had was driving for the sanitarium hotel. Second one here, a picture of him on horseback. And this is a picture of him in a warden uniform. And this was probably taken sometime between 1939 and about 42, as he does have the five stripes on his left arm there. And each of those, I think, signified 5 years in service. So joining in 14, this would have taken it to at least 39. Here's a picture of Bill. This one's featured in a lot of different books of him up at Simpson Pass. Another picture of Bill, a close-up. And this is Bill and his second wife, Ethel. And actually what he's holding in his right hand there is an artifact that's on, I believe the museum actually has this. It's a piece of wood, and he'd put what made it look like an eye of an owl in it. And another picture of Bill and Ethel. And she's actually, her sister was married to George Noble, the photographer. So he and George Noble were brothers-in-law. And quite a few of the pictures that I do have were taken by George Noble. And this was the third brother, Stephen, who lived at Anthracite. I think most know where Anthracite is. It was a small mining town just east of, on the road towards Calgary. Another picture of Stephen. And this was the market garden he had at Anthracite. And in the background there, you can see the hoodoos you see as you come along the highway. Now, Walter and his family lived at 433 Banff Avenue, which is actually right opposite where Beaver Street meets Banff Avenue. And he and his wife, Rosabelle Hay, who had come from Alexandria, Ontario, and she actually started coming out here in the early 1900s for the summer, working at the Banff Springs Hotel. And that's when he was driving the coach, I presume that's where they met. and they raised 6 children. This is a picture of their house on Banff Avenue. And here's a picture of the 6 children. And then another one when they're a little older. Now, the first warden hired in the park was Howard Sibbald in 1909. Bill joined the wardens in 1913, and then Walter joined in 1914. And he was assigned the job of town warden, a job he actually held for 34 years, although it was one short stretch when he was sent out to the Spray. And I think it was sort of some kind of a political thing that he was sent out there, and somebody else was appointed the town warden for a little less than a year. So he had the difference, he had the advantage, and like the other wardens, he didn't live in a cabin out in the backcountry. He was actually going home every night. Now these pictures are, I have a couple of the old diaries they used to have to send to Ottawa. And this is just a brief on the inside cover of what they had to, what we expected to do and report on every day. Another one here, just any matters of interest they may have noticed during the day. Prosecutions. And then anybody they employed fighting fire, he would write down their names. Now, in addition to sending these in, he did keep his own journals as well. And my sister, Margaret, had come across these about 15 years ago in an attic. And this was while I was teaching school. I started doing some of the work in the journals, but it wasn't until after I retired in 2000, about 2 years later, was when the first book was published. Now, the first one gave a fairly good, was reviewed by the Cragan Canyon, and the headline was "Tough as Nails, Warden's Journals Revealed." And Rocky Mountain Outlook did a review in the third one. Peto's journals are a rich document of early warden life. And what I found from reading it was hard work. It was in all kinds of weather, long days, very few days off. Now, the journals are quite graphic in certain areas. Sometimes his frustration shows through with certain things. He also talked a lot about problems he noticed and possible solutions. Now, one interesting entry from 1926 sort of sums up the working conditions. He says, "I hired as a fire and game guardian and have noticed that we have gradually had job after job added which have no connection with the warden's duties. Therefore, we must neglect our duties to do these jobs." So obviously he was a little fed up that day. And now, first job they had was fire guardians. This picture shows Walter on the left and Charlie Phillips on the right. And it was interesting, when I did get this photo from the White Museum, it said for Charlie, unidentified. And a man in Peterborough, probably in his mid-80s, sent me an email and said, "That's my father, Charlie Phillips, on the picture." So I was then able, when I did a reprint, to put his name on there. Second one shows Walter in the background and Howard Sibbald in the front with the fire pump. And the third one has Charlie Phillips on the left and Howard on the right in one of the first fire trucks. Now, a few journal entries about fires. And this first one, again, shows his opinion coming through. This was in 1916. "Called out at 5 a.m. to a fire next door. Stayed with the fire, throwing water on, while B. Fay went for the fire brigade. Got the fire under control by the time the fire brigade reached the house. Should be alarms at the ends of some of the streets." In other words, you figured if they had alarm box, we would have got there a lot sooner. 1916. "Up the Spray Valley in the afternoon to a new bridge. One foreman with aliens had a small fire get away. Guards would not let the aliens help him put it out." And the aliens were the people they had, a lot of Eastern Europeans that were detained in the camps. There was one near the Cavan Basin, and they had them in all these work parties. So obviously these guards were making the foreman had to put out the fire by himself, and the aliens just stood there and the guards and watched the guy putting it out. Now, an example of long hours. This was June 24th, 1919. "West at night to a fire 2 miles east of Lake Louise. Took up the fire pump. Started fighting the fire about 10:30 p.m. The next day, still fighting the fire for 19 hours. Fire burned about 85 acres. Now, an interesting area about fire, an interesting article about fire in 1922. "Went to Squirrel Street to investigate a fire. Found kids playing with a bonfire on the road. Made them get water and put out the same." Now, another one was game guardian duties. One thing was to protect the wildlife against poachers, but there was also a park policy where they had to control the predators, examples coyotes, crows, and cougars. But there was also a park policy of capturing certain animals, such as sheep and goats, which they would then ship to other parts of North America or even as far as Europe. Now, a couple of entries on poaching were two gentlemen, Malcolm Amos and Joe Blair. And these were in 1919. West on the auto road to the Sucker Spring, heard two shots on the hillside, caught Malcolm Amos with a Luger, confiscated same and brought Amos to town. He was tried by Collison and fined $25 in costs. Also, Joe Blair, who was driving Amos's car, was fined as an accomplice $5 in costs. Then about 4 months later, west on the auto road to the Sawback Hill with Warden Wood, looking for a car reported by McCauley. There from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m., out again at 10 p.m. until 7:30 a.m., watching for Amos and Blair, suspected of killing game. Met Amos at 2 a.m. walking towards town. He immediately jumped for the bush when he saw us. We went through his car earlier in the evening, nothing doing. So again, these two guys caused a lot of problems for them. Now, an example of how tough it would be sometimes following these poachers. This is from 1914. From Bankhead to the Ghost River Cabin by way of Devil's Lake to try and head off Harrison. We walked 23 miles and carried a pack. Got to the shack and found the roofing all blown off. Put in one awful night. Had to keep the stove red hot. Got no sleep. So not an easy night for them that night, chasing these poachers. Now, some of the predator control entries. This is from 1915. Saw guests at the Hot Springs Hotel trying to outrun a coyote in the bush. I having come to the Hot Springs to try and get the same coyote, but had to ride there for nothing. And 2 days later, nothing in the traps, but lots of tracks all around the traps. Going to quit night hunting till the coyotes get bolder and a new moon comes. And then one more entry, phoned Jay Warren that Bill Peto's dog had treed a mountain lion. Now, next photo is of the zoo. And the zoo opened in Banff. The cages were finished in 1908, and it was actually beside the Bow River in what is now Central Park. And they had a lot of the North American animals from the park there, but there were also non-native animals, such as monkeys and polar bears. And at one time, there was many 60 animals there. It was closed in 1937. And one thing, one of the tasks he had was to provide meat for the zoo. Often this was deer, elk, or sheep that may have been killed by trains or vehicles. However, if this didn't happen, he mentioned quite often that he had to kill an old workhorse and then take the meat to the zoo. Next one shows the picture of the children at the zoo. Now, a few entries from the zoo to the Sucker Spring catching fish for a polar bear. 1921, to Healy Lodge with Bill Peto's outfit to catch a porcupine and lynx for the zoo. Also in 1921, at the zoo with Warren to move the coyotes. Got bitten on the side of the head by the small one. Went to hospital and got wound cauterized, then moved the coyotes. Also 1921, I think this might have been rather interesting, at the zoo helping catch the grizzly bear to get his tooth out. So it would have been rather interesting, I think. Now another area where people, visitors to the park, could actually go and view animals was the Buffalo Park or Animal Paddocks. And this shows the buffalo, and that's the edge of Cascade Mountain in the background. So it was actually along the railway track on the way towards the Bankhead Station, and it opened in 1897. Now there were a lot of native animals there, like the buffalo, there were also the goats, but they also had animals like Angora goats, Persian goats, and four-horned goats that were not even native to North America. And this picture shows the three members of the Woodworth family. On the left is Father Ben Jr. in the middle, and then Joe was on the right. Now, a couple of entries about the Buffalo Park. This is 1914. To the Buffalo Park, cutting the yak's teeth with Howard and Mr. Cordes. Also, 1915, out to the Buffalo Park in the afternoon, in charge, as Woodworth got attacked by the old bull yak. 1916, traveled through the yak pasture looking for a coyote. Found the old cow yak was stuck in the mud in the creek with a calf. Got Melville to help me pull out the cow after which I got the calf from the cow and gave the cow a drink of hot water and ginger. Saw the cow in the afternoon, and she seemed lots better. In 1917, at the Buffalo Park, helping round up elk for pictures, got chased by the old bull. Now, the sheep traps, and he does report, in his entries, he does report there were a lot of sheep around. You know, a lot more, I think a lot more in the way of animals than we have nowadays. And these, there was two of these. One was west of Banff, the other one was up the Spray River Valley. And there is an example of some of the sheep in the trap. And a picture of Walter on the right and two others with one of the sheep. And a few entries on this about the sheep traps and also the shipping of animals. At the Buffalo Park all day catching sheep. Went to the station at night and helped out. Took down one crate and loaded the sheep on the express car till 7:30. Noticed there was no sign of ticks on the sheep. 1920, up the Spray to the Loop. Loaded up four goats with Bill Peto. Took the same to the park and turned them loose. 1921, to the park and loaded the yak on the train. Left Banff at 7 p.m. with the yak heading for Wainwright. And it took 3 days to get to Wainwright with him and his load of yak. 1926, at the warden's stores and finished boxes to ship animals to the Toronto Zoo. Caught a marmot and put it in the cage. Only one living. Two were supposed to be shipped. Warden E.W. Peto had a young one at his house that he'd been raising by hand, so he sent it on the one from the zoo on train number 4. Now, he also mentions quite a bit about different bird and animal entries, and often he would report these to Norman Sanson. And this is a picture of Norman Sanson up in the observatory on Sulphur Mountain. So an entry about animals. Saw two large buck deer in my yard this evening. Very bold. One tried to stand me off. 1925, caught a large horned owl in the coyote trap. Took the same to the zoo. 1916, took rock salt along the road for sheep. How many remember when they did put the salt out for the animals? They actually put them along the different roads. And 1917, making nesting boxes for birds around the museum grounds. 1922, out in the evening to try and rescue a young deer off the falls, off the ice at the falls. Now, there's also the fish hatchery in Banff, which were actually located on Glen Avenue near the falls. And it was operated there from 1914 until about 1956. And then it was moved to Dutt Hill, just east of Banff, and later to Anthracite. By the 1960s, the fish hatchery operations had ended in the park. Some of his entries about fishing, rode to good fishing points and watched the fishing parties did not exceed the limit. Water too high for really good fishing. 1915, watching streams around Banff for fishermen with small fish. The boys are the most trouble, wanting to keep the undersized fish. 1916, took up several lines left in the creek overnight by kids. Now, another job he seems to have had that wasn't probably in the normal warden description was the dogs and cat problem. So he often mentioned about being on the lookout for dogs and cats running loose and bothering wildlife. And also, sometimes people didn't want their dog or cat anymore. Walter was expected to take it to the dump and destroy it. So again, not in the normal part of the duties. And 1916 entry, about town with Fife in the afternoon, getting a count on the dogs at large to summon the owners. 1917, out near my house in Banff Avenue, got two male dogs and two female. Two males were causing disturbance every night, scared the rest about to death. Now, this next entry is rather interesting. It involves three people, A.E. Welby, who worked for the Parks Department, Jay Wood, who was a former superintendent, by this time was chief engineer of parks, and Norman Luxton, a very well-known local citizen. And this is in 1925. To the police court at night on Welby dog case. Lost the case as J. Doe witness, who beat the dog off the deer in his yard and saw it was Welby's dog, could not recognize the dog which was brought into court. The case was dismissed. Saw J.W. and Mr. Welby talking to N.K. Luxton at the bank corner immediately after court. So presumably, they brought either Luxton's or Wood's or whoever else's dog into the courtroom, and it wasn't Welby's, and this poor citizen was not able to identify the dog he'd seen in his yard. So, 1926, to Otter Street to try and get Jay Wood's cat out of a tree, but not being a squirrel, did not go up after it. Now, I also mentioned quite a few entries about horses and just some of the work with the horses. This one's from 1915. To a crossing of 40 Mile Creek via Mount Edith Pass, accompanied by Warren and Tex Wood, to try and get pack horses out that were drowned. The creek was running wild, could not get anything out. 1919. To the Buffalo Park in the afternoon, caught up a colt, pulled out porcupine pills, quills from his nose. Also 1919, took Heine, and he brought him, and it was a sorrel horse from overseas, to the sheep pasture. And it's an interesting story about Heine, that he was actually belonged originally to the Russian army, and then he was captured by the Germans, and eventually the Canadian army brought him back to Canada, and he was turned over to the parks here in Banff. And luckily I never came across an entry where Heine was meat for the zoo, which was nice to see, so... Another entry about horses, 1922. Got a call at 6:30 p.m., re-horses in the slough. Went up with McCauley, McTrow, and Spencer and found two pack horses in center of bog, almost covered. Put in a plank to get to the same and pulled them out with the team. Now, next photo. How many here have been to the warden's, or to the hermit's cabin near Johnson Lake? And this is an entry... first entry when I actually found that Billy Carver was living there. Went up to Johnson Lake or Blue Lake with Vic and Rod. Came onto a man living in a shack in thick pines. Told me he had been there 8 years. No one has seen him at any time. He talked good English. Intend to investigate him again. And 3 days later, they went back out there. Went to the shack in Anthracite with Morrison, P.C. Walker, and Deputy Warden Wright. We did not find the man at home. Wright and P.C. searched but found nothing suspicious. Mr. Morrison and I saw four deer near the shack and noticed they were not at all scared. So they just left him living there. And he actually hasn't lived in it since about 1937. And that's still the condition it was in 2002. Now, I also mentioned a lot about vehicles. Vehicles were constantly breaking down. Roads weren't in very good shape. And this series of entries is from the first week in November, 1921. First day, left Banff, got as far as Harmattan on our way to the Red Deer Valley via Cochrane and Sundry. Had one blowout and broke a small spring under the truck. Day two, getting the spring repaired in the forenoon. Went to the coal camp in the afternoon, had trouble with brakes. Day three, fixed up brakes in forenoon, went to Logan's Ranch, car not working well. Day four, laid over at Logan's Ranch, fixing brakes, etc. on the car. Day five, car not working, unable to move at times. Went as far as Cremona, roads very heavy. Had to get car hauled out of mud. Had to camp at the foot of a hill in Willows overnight. And day six, got hauled up hills, got to a telephone line and made up one's mind to either advance the timer or break it that was on so solid. Managed to move it. Had to buy coal oil. Could not get gas. After a while, met a man who gave us 3 gallons on the condition that we would get his car filled in Cochrane. Now, just a few pictures of roads. This is the road near Lac des Arcs, and the mountain on the far side is actually where the Trans-Canada runs nowadays. This is a picture of the East Gate, which was near Exshaw. Picture of the Radium Road. That's Howard Sibyl in the picture. And a little better Radium Road here.
Is it Radium?
Yeah, the road to Radium. And here's a picture of a house being moved from Bankhead, probably either to Banff or Canmore. And this picture is at Lake Minnewanka before they raised the level of the lake. And then a couple near Johnson's Canyon. And then the second one. Now, a few other entries that I found rather interesting. This one's from 1915. This was in March. Saw no less than 11 persons between the hot springs and the golf links. It must be a sign of spring, as 5 of them were ladies. Now, I also mentioned putting coal oil in stagnant water to kill mosquitoes. 1919, to the observatory with the superintendent and the Governor General's party. 1922, visited Belmore Brown and saw paintings of sheep, only those given to the curling club. 1922, met Mr. Rungus near Three Mile Board. 1922, along the auto road with E.W. Pito gathering evergreen to make a wreath for Mr. Vick, and in the next day they went to Mr. Vick's funeral. 1932, saw three boys going along the track, went to the sheep field of the park and saw the same boys on the hillside who ran away, found an old car 437 stripped, took Warren to town where he reported to Police Sergeant Taylor, who sent men to watch for the boys. No success. Two boys seen later by the sergeant at the barracks where boys were confessed to taking parts. And then 10 days later, to the Buffalo Park with the boys, reassembling the parts in car 437, which the boys had been ordered to do by Magistrate Wilson. Now, a few other areas where he patrolled around town. This one's Mather's boating business. They operated along the river. In 1923, there was a large flood in town, and this is Mather's house. And then you can see the extent of the flood here. Now, I also mentioned going to the recreation grounds. Quite often they were there doing things like burning grass. And then Moffitt's Dairy, which was across the tracks. I think somewhere probably in the area where the arena maybe now it is. I'm not sure exactly where it was, but it was somewhere on the far side of the tracks. And an old picture of the Banff Station. And this is one of the royalty visits. I'm not just sure which one this was. One of the princes had come over from England. And a picture of the golf course. And quite often when he was doing patrols, he'd mention going to the golf course and then the loop, because the garbage dump was actually down that same road where the golf course is nowadays. Picture of the Cave and Basin. The Alpine Clubhouse. That was actually on the road up towards the Upper Hot Springs, I believe, is where it was. It's no longer there. And then the observatory on Sulphur Mountain. And this is a picture of the Ice Palace. And he mentioned in 1917 that he was actually helping build the Ice Palace, and one of the workmen dropped a block and tackle on his head. And so he had to go and get some stitches, and he came right back, and he was right back at the job. And the paper mentioned that he was a tough nut, and other people would have been off for a couple of weeks, but he was right back at work. And there's a ski race on Banff Avenue. You can see the white, Dave White building there on the right, which is still there. And then another picture of the Winter Carnival. And some of the things he was expected during the Winter Carnival was also setting up teepees, taking part in activities such as ski joring when they were pulled by a horse on skis, also wood chopping and packing. Now later on, as Mount Norquay became operational as a ski resort, he did mention about they were going up there on traffic, duty, trying to control the vehicles. And at times, I don't think he was that impressed with that. And if somebody got hurt, quite often he was the one that brought them down for medical attention. Some of the other jobs he was involved with was delivering materials and food to different road crews or trail building crews. He was also accompanying different national park photographers who were out taking pictures, probably for promotional purposes. Sometimes he was out with film crews. One time he wrote about government workers dumping garbage along a ditch. Another time when he was out patrols, he mentioned that there were fish in the Cascade River stuck in ponds where there was insufficient water. And the fact is that these fish were probably not going to survive. Now, one of the wardens he worked with was Scotty Wright. And Scotty was on patrol. His area was around Lake Minnewanka. And there's a picture of the cabin in Minnewanka with Scotty and his wife and Howard Sibbald standing there with them. This is the cabin at Massive, and those are Tex Wood's children. In the East Gate cabin, and in the cabin near Spray Lakes, this was the cabin near Spray Lakes, a little more primitive than the others. And now a couple of pictures of wardens' conferences. This conference was in 1932, and this is one of the, an enlargement of this picture was actually one they gave away as one of the silent auction items this past weekend at the wardens' 100th anniversary celebrations. And this picture is from the 1933 conference. And Walter's in the back row on the right, and Bill's in the front row, second from the right. And next to Bill is Bruce Mitchell, a young Bruce Mitchell, who had probably just first joined the wardens. Now, a few entries we had about family. 1916, found a doctor and nurse at the house when I reached home. Daughter was born at 6:30. 1916 in December, nearly shot myself in the back of the head while taking a rifle through a window of a stable at the mill. November the 11th, 1918, woke at 2 a.m. by a fire bell announcing peace, went uptown and celebrated with the crowd, had a car in the parade in the afternoon, hauled wood for a fire at night. 1921, patrolling to Johnson's Canyon in Hillsdale, took the family for a ride. Now, here's a good example, this one, of how he took a situation and improved upon it. 1923, got a word my younger daughter had been run over. Went to Dr. Atkin and found she'd been run over by a Ford car traveling very slow at the corner of Banff Avenue and Buffalo Street at the taxi stand. The car ran full length up her body and face. Luckily, no bones were broken. Took mother and child home in the car, purely an accident. Little girl ran out from fountain. Next day, 1923, met with Commissioner Harkin at the zoo. He asked me how the little girl was and where the accident occurred. I pointed out the spot and how it was impossible to see the end of the sidewalk and that I intend taking the matter up with the superintendent to get the telephone box moved back and also the taxis to stand back one half of a car length. Mr. McLaren, who was driving the car in the accident, said he could not see the sidewalk at all on account of the taxis being so close. 1923, next day, saw the superintendent read the taxi standing too close to the corner, and he said he would get their phone moved and compel them to stand 25 feet from the sidewalk. These orders were carried out. Another entry from 1925, took Mrs. Staple, and she was the one that ran the East Park gate for about the same amount of time as Walter was the warden. He said he took her to Kananaskis in a Dodge car after she'd been to the dentist. Also took Mrs. Pito and two girls for the ride. Now, quite often there were tragic incidents. There were searches for different people and sometimes, you know, different rescues. Some didn't turn out as well as others. This was from 1918, up the Spray Valley to the Eau Claire camp, looking for four men's bodies that were drowned this morning. Located the boat bottom up 1/2 mile below the camp. Help turn it over. 1925, July 15th. Called out at 12 midnight to look for a man on Rundle Mountain. Left the campground with the chief warden at 12:45 a.m. On Rundle Mountain, located the man in a ravine at 2:45 a.m. Found also that he was unhurt. We waited for daylight, went above him, and directed him as he climbed towards the upwards to several hundred feet. We arrived at the CP Hotel at 6 a.m., home until noon, and then at noon he went back out on duty again. 1925. Called out after supper to take a search party to Squaw Mountain to look for three girls. Found the same on the northern slope in thick timber. Back to the auto road at 1:20 a.m. Girls a little scared and cold. Two Swanson girls and Winnie Harris. 1926, called at 9 p.m. that R.S. Fox had not returned from Healy Creek, where he had gone by boat. Went to the Healy Trail by car, walked to Healy Creek, and then to the boat landing, and returned to Banff at 3:45 a.m. Had found Mr. Fox at the landing, intending to wait for daylight, as it was very dark and not possible to follow the right trail without a light. And in a series of incidents where he mentions about Bill Mitcheltree, who was the local butcher who had drowned, and about a month after he had drowned, Walter did find the body along the river. Now, one of the more interesting entries, this is quite a long entry, this occurred in 1931. West of the 7 mile board and sheep trap, up behind the hill at 5.5 mile into a basin, I saw what appeared to be a roof close to the ground, investigated and found a long hole dug and a small hole for entrance. I looked in and discovered the skeleton of a man fully clothed, except for boots which were standing in the corner. Before disturbing anything, I left for town and notified the sergeant of police, whom I drove out together with a constable and the coroner Thompson. Chief Warden Warren and Warden Potts came out to the scene of my discovery. The man had apparently dug his grave, as there was no sign of him having any food there. The police and coroner took charge of papers, a letter dated 1926, but there was a CPR timetable dated August the 1st, 1928, which would point to this man having been there for 3 years. From the condition of clothes and other things, I do not think he could have been there that long, as only parts of the clothing that were touching the damp ground were rotten. The machine shirt that was on his remains could not be torn. An overcoat and the boots were in good condition, the laces of which had not been chewed by mice or any other small animals, as no large animal had been in. This skeleton or grave could not be discovered from other hills above, as it was too much like surrounding countryside. Old black burnt wood of which this hollow was covered. And then the next day he went back out there with the constable, and they buried the gentleman's remains, and he did mark his name, Eugene Bourgeois, on the grave. So it was a mystery as to where this fellow had come from or why he was even there. Now, last two slides. This one shows somebody trying to entice a couple of bear cubs. So quite different than we have nowadays. Next one, people feeding a bear. Now, last two entries I have, and these sort of show the difference or the difficulties they had as wardens sometimes trying to please people. And the first one is in June the 14th, 1921, to Lady MacDonald Cottage after the bear in the afternoon and back at night. The bear came out and was shot by Bill Pito with a .303 pointed bullet. As this bear did not fall at once, Mrs. Wes Jones and her husband declared it was not touched, and that we had gone there with orders not to shoot the bear, but only to scare it, and said she would write to Ottawa and get us discharged. And in fact, she spoke in a very insulting manner for one that was supposed to be a lady, just because we would not go and sit in the house or on the veranda. We took the only position from which it was possible to do any shooting, as there were so many people walking through the woods. Bill Pito stayed near the house all night, as they would not be told the bear could not come back. And the very next day, we went to the camp at the golf links with Bill Pito and shot a bear that had been molesting the camp. Mr. Wood, the superintendent, came along and evidently to show his authority said, "Is this the right bear?" We told him we did not ask the bear, as he'd already been in one tent. He said he was not going to have them shot. Chief Warden Sybil came along and was satisfied that we shouldn't worry. So that's the last entry I have. So does anybody have any questions or comments? Okay.
What year was it that he went to the he discovered the hermit?
About 1916. And the hermit had obviously been there 8 years, so he'd been patrolling for 2 years as a warden and didn't even know the guy was there. So, and then he mentioned 1937 that two boys from Anthracite had found the warden quite sick, or the hermit quite sick in his cabin. And so Walter and about three others went up there and carried him out by stretcher. And he ended up being moved to some kind of a nursing home in Gleeson, and that's where he died and was buried. And we've actually been to the cemetery there, but there's no grave marked with Billy Carver at all. So probably just a pauper's grave. And
were all your brothers buried in
there? My brother, no, I just, no.
Stephen
actually came, when he came from England, he actually had four children. He and his wife had four children they brought with them. Okay. And he lived for a while in Cochrane, and before he moved to Anthracite.
Cochrane?
Yeah. Okay. And then Bill had two wives. He had a son from the first wife, Emily, and then there was she had died, and then he married Ethel. So any other questions or comments?
And what happened to the five children?
You know, six children in the family?
Children,
yeah, my father was the oldest one. He was also Walter. And then there was Stan, who lived, was born, he spent all his life in Banff. And a third brother, Sid, who died in the 1930s. And then a daughter, Edith, another son, Harold, and then the last daughter was Helen. She spent most of her adult life in Ontario. It was interesting. I was at a fair in Calgary not that long ago, and a man came up and he says, "I'm related to you." He said, "My grandmother's sister married your grandmother's brother," which was Tommy Hay. My grandmother's maiden name was Hay, and this guy's great aunt had married my great uncle. So I guess it's a relationship, but yeah. Yeah, most of these are from the White. A few of them, like the one of the children in the zoo, that was a family one. And but the majority from the White. And most of the ones they do have are either Byron Harmon's or George Noble's, the bulk of the pictures. And
but your sister found the
diaries, yeah. There's
15 years ago.
Yeah, there's the whole box. Yeah, there's a whole box of them just in books like this.
Wow.
And it took about 8 years to get them on the computer because the writing at times wasn't that clear. Sometimes it was just in pencil.
Were there any pictures with them?
No, there wasn't, no. And then this was the example of these, when I showed you at the start of the little diaries they had to fill in. So he was actually doing double writing. He was filling in this and submitting it, but he was also writing his own journals. I don't know where he found the time, but... Yeah, it is sort of a different kind of a picture, because not the, you know, like it wasn't sort of the, you know, it was much more... You know, dealing with just a lot of the different problems in town.
Seems almost frontier.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost like you can kind of look like a town marshal. The one thing that I'm a bit unclear on is when you say town board, how is that sort of jurisdictionally different from a park board? I mean, obviously there's a difference between coming up, but was he a federal?
Yeah, he was part of the same, he was a warden the same as the rest, but his responsibility was the town and the area immediately around it. So on patrols, he would go to Bankhead, maybe as far as Minnewanka. He'd check all up by the hoodoos. He'd go west to towards Johnson's Canyon. So
yeah, listening to your thing, I thought, you know, he must have been outside of town as well. So basically, he was part of the warden's service?
Yeah, he was one of the wardens, and his assignment was the area was the Banff area itself, right in town. I've heard a lot of them have actually been destroyed. That somebody in Ottawa made a decision back some years ago that all these that were all being sent in from all the wardens across Canada. And as far as I know, a lot of them were destroyed, so I'm not sure why, but. Because I think they would have been quite interesting as well. But it's interesting in doing these and doing the books, I've actually met a lot of people who have had relatives mentioned in the books. And one person here tonight, his father, McTrow, was mentioned, or the grandfather. Yeah. And I've met, you know, people like the Jack Naylor was one of the ones. I met relatives of his and relatives of Tom Staple.
We know Macaulay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it may be in the same one, yeah. He did have his differences with him, too. Macaulay sort of seemed to run a lot of the, you know, the services in town, and sometimes he said, you know, Macaulay wouldn't give him a vehicle to go and pick up sheep from the trap. And then one time he had to move two bears, and he took him, I guess, to the zoo, and he said it was a fast drive, he says, so, because he had these two bear cubs in the back seat, so. Well, it was... So any other questions at all? Just like to thank you for coming.
And I have one more question.
Okay.
We have the story of the Yakima during the tour of the heritage walk about the lynx and the zoo.
Yes.
The bill people, of course.
Yes.
Is that a true story?
As far as I know, it is. Yeah. Do you think so, Gordon? As far as we know, it is. But I'm letting the lynx go.
Well, I think Bill Peto took the lynx. He had it tied up.
Yeah.
I don't think he let it go.
No.
He took it into the bar and everybody ran outside, supposedly.
Yeah.
And then they put it in the zoo, but I don't think he let it go.
But But didn't he have it chloroformed or something? It was probably just starting to come too, I guess.
I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah.
That's what I've heard anyway.
Yeah.
The stuff of legend.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. It's one of those things you may never know the real story, I guess. Yeah.
Well, there's a picture of it.
Yeah.
A picture.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was his
cabin named Alexander
Stevens? Sorry, his cabin?
Yes. Yeah, that's where Stan's house was built, yeah. Yes. Yeah, I remember when we were kids, when we were first starting, we were up here one summer and they were just, you know, tearing down the old house and before they built the new one, so. Yeah.
Well, folks, I would like to once again thank Mr. Vito for coming and sharing these reminiscences of his grandfather and a few of his own. And boy, he knows how to present history, don't you think?
Yes.
And so, again, we have a few books on sale in the shop, and I understand you're going to be signing, yes?
Yes.
The table right back here. So if you'd like to purchase a book and come on back and have it signed, I'm sure you'd like to do so. Otherwise, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.